Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where I talk with people about how we all get free. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very happy that you're here with me today. One of the reasons I love doing this podcast so much is that I get to speak with people making a difference in their corner of the world, people who saw a problem and decided to do what they can to make things right. My guest today, Emerald Snipes Garner, is the youngest daughter of six children and is currently the executive director of her nonprofit, We Can't Breathe Incorporated, which is named in honor of her late father, Eric Garner, and her sister, Erica Garner. She is the author of Finding My Voice, On Grieving My Father, Eric Garner, and Pushing for Justice. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Emerald to the podcast today. Hi, Emerald. I'm so glad you're here with me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am doing well. And I have to say, you know, when I was reading your book, I thought, I can't even imagine all the things you're taking on. And the thing that sort of struck me was you didn't start off intending to be an activist. Activism found you through the murder of your father and the untimely death of your sister, Erica. So how do you navigate taking on the responsibility of really pushing for justice for them on top of all the other things that you are responsible for, your child, your sister's children? How do you just move through the world and keep all those balls up in the air?
At this point, I feel like an octopus with so many arms. I'm juggling a lot. You know, the kids, they're a lot. But we're working it out together. We're finding a system. We're finding a way to function. And it's been very difficult. But I think that finding the balance is being able to focus on the kids, have time for them, focus on my career, have time for that, focus on myself, you know, having time for that. So it's just trying to balance those things. So every time I get a minute to just do nothing, I take advantage.
This is a very wise thing because, you know, something that's in the conversation a lot right now is rest and how most of us need a lot more rest than we're getting. And I don't by rest just mean sleep. I mean also just disconnecting from all of the things we're responsible for and just letting our brains and our nervous systems kind of calm down. And anyone with children knows that that's already challenging. But you're also working to create this organization and build out this organization that you want to have make profound social change. And that right there is a huge task. And I want to start with talking about trauma, because right now we hear the word trauma thrown around pretty casually. You know, people say, oh, that was so traumatic. I'm like, no, trauma is not a bad experience at the grocery store, right? You know, someone banged into you with their cart. What happened to you and your family was actually a traumatic experience. And for those who don't know the backstory, would you tell us what happened to your dad and then how this has led you into the work that you're doing?
On July 17th in 2014, my father was killed by a police officer in Staten Island due to a chokehold. And, you know, that just spiraled into a viral video and us just being plastered all over the news, us, me, and my family. And it led to us, you know, getting the story out, seeking justice. And ultimately, we didn't get the justice that we deserved, but we pushed through and we received some forms of justice. I feel like justice to everyone has a different face. In our case, we didn't get the police officers arrested. They weren't indicted. A lot of things didn't happen for us, but we were able to get the Eric Garner law. We're able to advocate for other families of community violence and police brutality. And we're able to come together as a community of survivors and do what means the most to us. So I think that when we face these traumatizing situations, we try to find a way to kind of put our minds and our hearts at ease. And it sometimes it takes 8 years and sometimes it takes 8 months. And, you know, it's not an easy transition. And sometimes it'll take the lifetime. And for some people, there's no going forward. And I try to push through and let people know that there's another side to this.
Yeah, I mean, that's really important. And your sister was the one, your sister Erica was the one who initially, after your dad's murder, picked up the baton and said, okay, I'm going to push for change because this should never have happened and it should never happen again. And then she passed away unexpectedly of a heart attack when she was very young, leaving you to take in her children and raise them. And I'm curious because that by itself would be a terribly traumatizing experience, not just for you as someone who'd recently lost her father, but now also your sister is gone. Now also you are responsible for your sister's kids. They're also traumatized because their mother is gone, or the one who was old enough to understand what was happening. And I'm curious as to how you work to break that cycle of trauma, not only for yourself, but for your sister's kids and your own child, because that cycle of trauma is something that I think particularly people of color, Black people, are very familiar with in this country. And we are trying to break those intergenerational traumatic circumstances. So how do you address this so you're not just passing it on from one family member down on for the next 5 or 6 or 7 generations?
Right now, I'm really focused on making sure that they're finding some type of normalcy. They were in it with us. So in the beginning, we were taking Kaylee and Alyssa, that's my daughter and my sister's daughter, to protest. And then, you know, stuff started getting a little out of hand with the riots and stuff like that. So we stopped taking them to protest. Me and my daughter, we were already receiving mental health services. And then when my sister passed away, my niece started receiving services as it pertains to our mom. And my nephew is 5 now, so he's starting to receive his services. And I think that it was really important to find another person for them to talk to that was outside of the box. I didn't want my niece to feel like if she shared certain details about, you know, how she's living, how she's going, and they're going to come back and tell me, and then I'm just going to know everything. So it just, you know, she's like, oh, if I talk to grandma, she's just going to go tell my aunt anyway. But I wanted her to be able to have another outlet to express her feelings and express how she really, really feels without feeling like, oh, did I say too much? Did I not say too much? Are they going to tell my aunt? And I told her, like, if you're not going to hurt yourself or hurt anybody else, whatever you say to your therapist is between you and your therapist. So I think that that helped her to find a lane of her own to say, okay, well, I know if I'm having a really, really tough day, I could talk to you about these things. But if I'm feeling like I want to talk to somebody else and get a different perspective, I have my therapist, or I have this person, or I have that person that I could talk to. So that was important.
Yeah, I think that's really wise, especially because, you know, in the Black community, there's a very fraught relationship often with getting mental health services. And actually, something that you talk about in the book that I thought was really interesting in the context of this is that you said one of the things you want to create is a 24-hour community center for youth as one way of addressing the crisis of lack of care for kids in our community, and not just physical care, but also a place for emotional care for them. So would you speak about what your vision for that 24-hour community center would be?
Yeah, so I want to have like a multi-youth center. Now, I started the nonprofit, and the 3 pillars are Hearts for Justice, After Five for Justice, and Job for Justice. And I really focus on After Five for Justice because when I was a teenager, there wasn't a lot of places to go past like 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and it was difficult to find things proactive to do. And now in these days, it's even more difficult to find things to do. So I wanted to make sure that there was a number that somebody can call. We're working on building out, you know, safe spaces where we can, you know, help people come from where they are in a traumatic situation to a safe space where they could think it out, think it through. You don't have to be in the situation to figure out how you're going to get out of the situation. You need a peace of mind. So I want that center to be a place where young people can come, call, text, email, or whatever. Somebody's available to meet them where they are. You know, like sometimes you just need to talk it out. Like, I'm so frustrated today. Like, I know that I'm not going to leave my job today, but I need to vent about some of the things that's been going on. And if I tell this person, they're going to go to the boss and then I'm going to get fired. But if I have another person to talk to and help me work out how I'm going to deal with my work issues or school issues, it'll help me better navigate finishing the job or finishing school or finishing the task that I have at hand.
So you're really looking at it as kind of a crisis hotline in a way, right? That if someone's struggling.
Right. It's like a crisis all in one.
Right. Exactly. It's like, okay, you're struggling with this. You can either make a call, or if you have physical proximity to where the center is, you can go in there directly. But you're sort of looking at it as sort of whole service environment for people, young people who are in a situation where they may not know what to do, they may not know how to do it, even if they know what to do, et cetera. Is that about right?
Right, absolutely. I always encourage the youth that I work with. They're like, oh, you know, I need to get a job. I'm like, okay, so you need to get a job, but how are you going to get to the job? Do you have the proper attire to work at that job? Because if you're a hostess, you have to, you know, wear a certain outfit. Not all jobs require a uniform. So if you work at the job, do you have sufficient clothing to feel comfortable to do your job? If you work in customer service and you don't have the proper clothing, then, you know, you can't do customer service in sweatsuits. So you might want to put on a business suit because it makes you feel empowered. You don't have money to buy a business suit. So we have other programs like Just for Success. There's Goodwill. They offer job interview clothing. So, you know, the young person may not know about those services because they're young people. So, exactly. You know, they don't know about Just for Success. They don't know what the Goodwill offers. All they know is that the Goodwill is where you drop off things that you don't want. But they don't know that there's so much more to that. So it's a part of teaching them how to navigate and how to find the resources that they need. So I was a part of plenty of programs and internships, but I can get an internship and they'll pay me every 2 weeks to go to this internship. And then over here is where I go to get a Metro card because I need to get to the internship. And then over here is where I get to meet with my job counselor because they're going to help me to write my resume so that if this is not what I want to do, I can go somewhere else. So I've always had to go to multiple places to get the things that I needed. So if there was one place that was consistent for young people to go find the things that they need and actually help to build out what it is that they want to do, I think that it'll be helpful for young people because when you have these crises, it's like there's nobody really there to focus on what your issue is because a lot of your elders are like, well, I have bigger things to deal with. I have to deal with this. I have to deal with that. So for us, it's very small. But for them, this is their life. And this is all that they know. And this is the crisis that they're in. So it doesn't matter how small it is. They still need the support to build it out and figure it out.
I really appreciate that you say that because I often have had the thought that people forget. It's like we get older and we forget how important things feel when you're younger. I mean, it's so much more a part of your life and you don't have the whole backstory of time where you get to see that, oh yeah, most things work out. So diminishing the importance of those things for young people, I've always felt that that was really harmful, that you're doing them a disservice when you're saying, oh, that's not a big deal, or I don't have the time for this. So I really appreciate that you are thinking in this holistic way of creating a space for young people that can support them and also coincidentally help keep them out of environments that are potentially dangerous for them. If they have somewhere to go that is a safe space, a welcoming space, a space where people are upholding the best of them, then they're less likely to wind up in a space where trouble is around the corner. So I think that that's also really, really important. And as I said, I appreciate that you're working on that.
Thank you.
So I want to get back to your father's story a bit. Because on June 8th, 2020, the Eric Garner Anti-Chokehold Act was signed into law in New York State. And, you know, the timing of that, it was just a couple of weeks after the murder of George Floyd, right? And he repeated the words that your father said before his death, "I can't breathe." I would love to hear you talk about getting that act passed in New York State, what it means for you. And then also, it's the law here in New York, but you all are working to make it a federal law so that it would apply across the board. So would you talk a bit about that as well?
Yes, we're working with Kirsten Gillibrand and Elizabeth Warren to represent it so that it can become a federal law, because the killings haven't stopped, unfortunately, and the list keeps getting longer. And as I've stated before multiple times and in the book, we need the right people in the right seats in order to get the change that we want. So it's not just about going out to vote. It's going out to vote for the person that could make the change that we need, that can pass the policies that we need passed and pass the laws that we need passed. So that's why I always encourage people to go out and vote, know your state, know who's in the seats, know who what they stand for, know what they support, because I see how difficult it is to navigate. So it's like making sure that things are in order and we have the support that we need. We need that from elected officials, from our council members, our Senate members. We need the right people in. So I always say that it's important to get involved in your communities.
How did you get that Anti-Chokehold Act passed? How did you manage to do that? That's an enormous accomplishment.
We did a lot. I definitely send a lot of love and light to change.org for helping me to amplify the petition that I started. We got over 100,000 signatures, and I think it was like a week. And we did a lot of advocating. We did a lot of asking for signatures. And we were like, you know, we're going to get all of these signatures and we're going to take it up to whoever it needs to go to. So we were like gearing up for like this mass action. And we told them, like, if you don't pass this bill, we are going to have mass action. So I was just advocating for everybody, like, listen, on this day, we're going to have peaceful protests in this state, all at the same time. And we're going to let them know that we're serious about the things that we're doing. So it was just like a lot of the things that I saw and learned over the years of working with Reverend Sharpton and being under the leadership of Ashley Sharpton and going to the huddle and doing all of these things. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to take everything that I've learned over the past couple of years, and we're going to do all of those things again. And we're going to keep doing it until they pass these bills. And luckily, they got them passed.
Well, I'm going to say that luck was only maybe a tiny part of it. That, you know, bills don't get passed just because people are lucky. Bills get passed because people use the tools that are there to pass them. And you mentioned Reverend Sharpton and his daughter and how you learned things there from National Action Network. And I'm wondering whether you feel like that kind of education is something that should be taught in schools, basically. You know, I think of it as civics. It's like, how do you apply pressure to the levers of government so that they are responsive to the citizenry of their country? And you seem like you have learned how to take an idea from, this is what I want to have happen, and get it to, okay, here's a bill, it's now going to go to the state assembly, and then we're going to make sure that the governor signs it. So are these all skills that you learned from National Action Network and your association with Reverend Sharpton and the other people there?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the people that I met along this journey was from going to National Action Network. You never know who you're going to meet at a Saturday rally. And people say that all the time. And that's absolutely true. And I got connected with a lot of organizations, a lot of people through working with National Action Network. So I definitely do pay homage to them in my book. And I'm telling people, like, this is how I found my purpose. So I definitely utilize the skill of what I learned and how I could apply it to my everyday life and apply it to the things that I'm doing and the projects that I'm working on and using that to build up. So I definitely have done different sessions and different workshops where I try to educate people about how they can turn an idea into something that they really want to do, how to find their purpose, how to figure out what it is that they want to do to contribute to the movement. Because as I say all the time, I cannot go to every protest. I cannot go to every press conference because I have three children at home and it's very hard to get childcare and school pickups and drop offs and getting people ready for school and trying to get them out the door and taking a whole hour just to get out the door. It's just a lot. So
yeah,
I like to apply that and I like to share the knowledge that I have with people that are dealing with the same trauma that I'm dealing with.
And I think the other thing that's interesting to me in that is just the idea that you don't have to do everything. You know, no one person has to do everything. You can do the things that you can do. And there are other people there who are doing their piece, and collectively is how we get things done rather than taking it on like, this is all on me. Because if we do that, then it's too easy to get overwhelmed because there's just so much to do and we are only one human being at a time and there's just no way, right? So when you choose the things you're doing, are you very strategic about, I'm going to stay in this particular lane and let other people do their thing over here? Or do you get involved more broadly?
Right now, focusing on building up the infrastructure of We Can't Breathe, Inc., which is my nonprofit, we are figuring out the business side of it, but we're also doing advocacy, we're doing legislation, we're doing policy building. And if someone calls me and say, hey, like we're doing this project over here and, you know, we would like to get some insight, I'm always available to take calls, do consultations, do things like that, because a lot of people did a lot of meetings with me. So I asked a lot of questions and I'm like, hey, I want to do X, Y, Z, this, this, that, and the other. So they would just give me a list of a few pointers of things to do. Like, hey, I'm not sure what you could do on this end, but I know this, 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 and this is here. And if you reach out to these organizations and ask them the same questions, you'll get the answers. So I think that being able to share knowledge like that, being able to share different skills and different resources is definitely a plus. And I appreciate being able to do that, given the things that I've learned. So it's definitely a great experience.
Yeah, I always feel like that's the best way. It's like, let's share what we can. And our focus is our focus, but we will share what we can. And if everyone pays attention to their particular area, we will all get it done, right? It's like we support each other. So besides the Anti-Chokehold Act, are there other changes in laws or ways of holding law enforcement accountable that you are seeking?
So along with the Eric Garner Anti-Chokehold Bill, we had the Andrew Kearse Act and the Stephon Clark Law, which were the three pieces of legislation that we advocated for. So it was just for us, Andrew Kearse's wife, Angelique, and Stephon Clark's brother, Stephante. We were just advocating for those three bills to be passed. And we also advocated for other bills. We're advocating now for unqualified immunity. And also, you know, just making sure that we have, just keep the momentum up about these bills and making sure that they get federally changed. So I think that the work that we're doing, which is building out policy for the federal legislation, kind of like, you know, runs alongside with making sure that we encourage people to vote and that, you know, we tell people about the things that are happening. There are plenty of grants out there for startup organizations, women-led organizations, trans community organizations. There's a lot of support out there. So I think definitely going back to sharing knowledge and sharing the stuff that we have and being able to, I'm always looking to partner with other organizations because we can't do it all on our own. We can't do everything by ourselves. So we definitely need community to build.
I think that's really important because we live in a society that has a very much a competitive rather than a cooperative lens to it most of the time. And I always feel like that competition actually gets in the way of our accomplishing the things we want to accomplish because it puts us in an us versus them mentality rather than a us mentality together. And I just think that's really important. And I'm glad to hear you say that because I think the more we say that and the more we get that message out, the stronger our movements are going to be across the board. So I want to change gears here a little bit because I was walking down the street the other day and someone was wearing a t-shirt and it was a slogan about a political thing. And I started to think about how we have commodified crisis, right? It's like, I can't breathe t-shirts or Brittany Griner t-shirts or any kind of t-shirt like that, where someone's creating this t-shirt with the names or words said by victims of various injustices on them. And they're using them to make money. And at the same time that I appreciate that they are making these people's names more visible, making these circumstances more visible, I'm honestly kind of disgusted by someone making money off of the death or misery of someone. And as a family member, I'm curious as to what your feeling about that is.
I've always advocated for, you know, people to not do those things, but I can see how people want to, and sometimes it's not malicious. And I see that, like, you know, people are wanting to support, like, oh, I can't breathe t-shirt. It took a very long time for me to wear I can't breathe t-shirt. Mm-hmm. It was just a lot for me. Like, I didn't see it as a sign of disrespect. I saw it as a sign of solidarity. You know, they want to make sure that we get it out. You know, the more that is visible, the more that is out there. So I didn't see it as something malicious. So I appreciate the support for people that wore the I can't breathe t-shirts and they wore it as a show of solidarity.
Yeah, I guess my question is less about the people wearing it than the people making them, right? It's like, are you donating that money?
Not all the time. They're not donating it. The reality is people are making the t-shirts and they're not donating the money. Most of the time, the money doesn't come directly to the families. That's just the reality. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, I used to get upset about it, but at this point, it's just like people make t-shirts to make money. Would it be nice for them to donate the money? Yes, at the time, you know, it would have been nice. But thinking about it now versus then, it's like now it's like, okay, they made the shirts, they kept the money. Like, you know, what can you do? Are you gonna?
I see. I mean, I applaud your generosity of spirit on this.
It took a long time to get here, so I'm proud of myself too.
It still bugs me. It's like, come on, man, don't do that. On the other side of that, though, is, and something you mentioned in the book is how helpful it is when you have people who have huge social media platforms and they are amplifying your message. And you got a lot of support from basketball players, which was particularly meaningful to you, right? And would you talk about how that has really helped sort of put the message out there in a way that you, as an individual no one knows, you know, no one knew at the time, would have had a hard time with?
Like I said before in the book, I appreciated the players for wearing the shirts, and, you know, some of them got fined for it. And I'm not saying that getting fined was a good thing, but just knowing that they wore the shirts and they were like, you know what, we're going to stand up for this cause. It doesn't matter how much money we're getting fined for. So it's just like they helped each other out when it came to the fines. And I appreciate it. And I say it all the time, like, thank you for showing solidarity, because without that, like, nobody would have known who Eric Garner was, and they wouldn't have known what was going on, and it would have been one side of the story out there. It would have been the police side. So it amplified the story. It got us the very little bit of tiny little piece of 0.0% of justice that we received. So I definitely appreciate them for amplifying it.
Yeah. When people who have that kind of power put it out in that way, it always feels like a blessing, right? It's like, yes, thank you for making it possible for more people to know what's happening here than otherwise would know. So something else that I've thought about when I was reading your book was the transition from being a victim to a survivor, right? And not only for you, but for other people who have had experiences similar to yours, and how that transition allows you to go out and do the work that you are doing in the world. And I mean, I know that, you know, victims and survivors are not a monolith. You don't all have the same experience. But what's the experience of moving from victim to survivor been like for you?
It's been difficult because it took a while for me to see myself as a survivor. After my sister passed away and I started to realize most of the contributing factors to what happened to her. I'm like, you know, that could have very well been me too. So I say that, you know, I had to really take a seat and sit back and say, what is it that I really want to do? How am I really going to continue to live my life? What am I going to do with this life? And just figuring out, where do we go from here? So that's why I said I wanted to write the book. Hopefully that book turns into a documentary so that I can have sustainability for me and my sister's kids. You know, I have 3 kids to send to college. So what is it going to look in the next 5 years? We're sending my young people to college and making sure that they're safe and then that they move on into a life that is safe and comfortable for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if simply the fact of them and having to take care of them actually helped you make that transition from victim to survivor more quickly, because you kind of had to, right?
Yeah, I definitely had to.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, this is no longer a choice. This is a got to do this. So let me figure this out as I'm moving through it, because I don't know. And, you know, I think that often in life, that's the way it is. It's like, okay, I have no idea what I'm doing here, but I'm just going to keep putting one foot in front of the other and, you know, pray. So I am someone who deeply believes in the power of story to change the world. And when we hear people's stories about the experiences that they've had or the things they've seen, we understand them really differently and we find points of connection, right? And something that I think is really important is that survivors lead these conversations. And I can maybe imagine what it's like to be in your shoes, but you know what it's like to be in your shoes. You are living the aftermath of this every day. And I would love for you to talk about how amplifying survivor stories is such an important part of this process of changing laws. It's like, if we don't hear the stories, we don't get it, right?
Right.
So I'd love to hear about how you amplify other survivors' stories and how you encourage other survivors to use their stories as they can, because everyone's different.
I definitely talk about this a lot in the book, especially with the last couple of chapters with my interviews with other survivors. I talk to them mostly because when, you know, my story was happening, we were on every major news outlet. Everybody knew who we were. We were all over the place. And not every story gets to mainstream media. And I see that in the other survivors, that that's a really important part of what they feel. Like, oh no, like, how did you get on the news? How did you do this? How did you do that? And it's just like, you know, if you pay attention, a lot of the times it was my grandmother that was on the news or my sister that was on the news, because I really did not feel comfortable doing interviews or anything like that. But, you know, I mustered up the strength and I did what I need to do to get it done without taking the time and the care and the need that I needed for myself. So I just encourage them, if it's a no today, it's a no. If you schedule an interview and that day is just hard for you, like, let the interviewer know, like, today is a very hard day. Can we cut it shorter? Can we schedule a 5 minutes before, 10 minutes after, whatever? Like, you know, just try to make it comfortable for you, because you have to keep reliving this tragedy over and over and over again every time that you talk about it. So just letting people know how you feel and just setting your boundaries. Like, hey, I don't want to watch the video. Or I don't want to see this clip, or I don't want to see this picture because it's triggering. Like, just being able to voice those things would have been helpful for me at those times. So maybe it's not helpful for you, but this is what I learned over the past couple of years. I'll give you this knowledge so that it'll be a little bit easier for you. So I have a support group that meets on Mondays. It's a Healing Justice Village support group, and we meet, we support each other, we go to each other's events, we go to each other's protests, and we just decided to support ourselves because we're tired of putting out a call to action and nobody shows up. Or we put out, you know, hey, can you sign this petition? And everybody has 5,000 excuses why they can't sign a petition. But if a celebrity activist or a celebrity puts out something, you're quick to sign and you're quick to sign on. So those things like that are very, very little, but it definitely makes a big impact in our lives because we are fighting for the things. And if we have a petition, of course it means something to us if somebody signs it, especially if you say that you support us, you're with us. If we have a protest, like, I know that you can't stay the whole time, but could you come, show your face, put your feet in the vicinity of where we're protesting so that we can feel the support of just a little bit? If you can't come, send somebody you know. Like, you know what I'm saying? That's what people do all the time. So those are the things that we're looking for as support. So I started to let people know, like, tell them, like, listen, it would mean a lot to me if you were physically present in this space because I am fighting for justice and this is my way. It may not be the way that you're used to. It may not be something that you normally do, but it would mean a lot for me, for you to show up here. And I think that started to make a difference and encouraging them to speak up and say, like, I need you to be here physically so that I can feel support from you. I need you to do these things so that I can feel support from you.
I think that's really important because I think oftentimes what gets in our way isn't that we don't want to support someone. We don't know how. And so when you say, please do this, because this would mean a lot to me, you've just taken a huge obstacle out of my way. I don't have to try and guess, what does Emerald want me to do? It's like, oh, Emerald just told me what she wants me to do. So now I know. So I think that's really important. And I think that that's something that not only in this circumstance, but kind of across the board in life, it's like, if you want someone to do something, ask them. Nobody can read your mind, right? Even when we think we know you someone really well, we don't necessarily, so it's good to ask. Our time is almost up, and I just want to ask you to give the listeners three actions that they can do to help you make the changes that you are seeking. What are three things that would make a big difference in your work in the world?
The first thing is to get involved in any community action that means the most to you, whether it's a school board, things that involve your children with your mental health services or elderly services. Just get involved in something and figure out what your purpose is in your community. The second thing that I would say is follow me on social media, Emerald_Garner_on Instagram, Emerald Snipes on Facebook, and Twitter is We Can't Breathe Inc. And I have TikTok now. So it is Emerald Garner on TikTok. I'm going to start making videos really soon with the kids and stuff because that's what they really want to do. And I've been kind of hiding them from the world, but now I'm pushing them out there. And the third thing is to just check in on all your friends, check in on your peoples, check in on somebody that you haven't spoken to in a long time. Try to make amends with somebody who you left on bad terms with if it's worth fighting for. So those are the things that I would like to encourage people to do.
Thank you. So you're basically asking us to just try and be better humans. Okay.
In a different way, in a three-step way.
Yeah, we can do that. We can do that. Emerald, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the work you are doing in the world. I am so sorry that this is the path that you have been put on, and I am grateful that you are walking it with so much grace and so much generosity. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Most of us are fortunate to not have had our way into activism be through a tragedy such as the one Emerald and her family continue to navigate. We do our work without that weight. But don't for one minute think that what you do isn't important. We each make our contribution to the healing of the collective through our actions. Emerald is working in her corner of social justice. We work in our corners, and together we've got it covered. Often the beginning is when we sit down and listen to the stories that people have to tell, stories that give us a glimpse into their world and connect us to our shared humanity. Thank you for listening. I'll be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth soon. And until then, remember that change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.